Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
When I looked to join an organization in the wake of Sandy Hook, I could have supported a think tank in D.C., or I could have joined some of these individual state organizations, almost all of them run by men. And women are only 20% of Congress. We only hold about 25% of state legislative seats. We're less than 1% of Fortune 100 CEOs. So we aren't getting to make the laws and the policies that impact the safety of our families. And I think that women were looking for a way to do this that helped us pull the levers of power available to us, our votes, because we're the majority of the voting public, our spending power. We make about 80% of our family spending decisions, and our voices. You know, we show up in meetings and in every single gun bill hearing in this country. And when lawmakers see us, they're scared.
Today's guest, Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand Action, which now has over 5 million supporters, not all of them moms, and 300,000 active volunteers pushing for new gun legislation all over the country and also against legislation backed by the NRA. None of it existed before the end of 2012 when Watts, angry and frustrated over the Sandy Hook shooting, started a Facebook page. She wasn't an activist. She'd never been involved in gun legislation or any other kind of legislation. She didn't know much about politics. But she and a bunch of other mothers put their frustration and skills to work, concentrated them, and turned it into one of the biggest activist groups in the country, and one of the groups with the most results to show for its activity. These days, it's become a regular part of politics to see people fighting for the Moms Demand Action endorsement, wearing the t-shirt with its logo. It all happened very quickly, and in ways no one could predict. So that's why I wanted to have Watts on. Not just because guns have become such a major political issue, but because Moms Demand Action is a stunning model of how all the new groups forming across the spectrum, but especially on the left since President Trump's inauguration, can become really real, really quickly. They're not the only group that's been successful, but to see something this big and this effective happening off of a mostly volunteer network, granted, with Mike Bloomberg's backing coming a few years in, is something that I think you'll agree is worth paying attention to. Remember to hit that subscribe button and rate us and get everyone you know to subscribe and rate us too. Those midterms are coming up soon, under 90 days, and we're going to fill it out with episodes that you won't want to miss from people involved in campaigns all over the country. Remember to follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover and email me with your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Shannon Watts. So let's go through the origin story. You are not involved in any of the gun stuff, anything politically, and then Newtown happens. You told the story before, but look, it's how you get into this business, essentially.
This business. Yeah, I was a stay-at-home mom of five. Before that, I'd had a almost 20-year career in corporate communications, and as the mom of kids ranging from elementary, middle, high school, even college at that point, I was so devastated, but even more than that, angry, that I was watching pundits on television in the hours after this horrific mass shooting at a school that murdered 26-year-olds and six educators. I was watching them say that the solution was more guns. As if that was, you know, going to solve our crisis. If, in fact, more guns and fewer gun laws made us safer, we'd be the safest country in the world. So I decided that I wanted to join an organization like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, thinking, oh, sure, this already exists. I just have never plugged in. And I went online and I found nothing. I mean, I searched for hours. So I thought, well, I'll start my own Facebook page. And I really was not that active on social media. I didn't have an active Twitter handle. I didn't have that many friends on Facebook, fewer than 100.
Were you politically engaged? Were you someone who cared about what was going on in federal politics and state politics, local politics?
I was engaged. I was one of those people who fell for Obama's emails over and over again, that if I sent him $15, I might get to have lunch with him.
And the ones that were like from Barack Obama, like, hey, right? Like those?
I thought they were personally.
So you were like deeply sophisticated as a voter.
Exactly. But, you know, other than that, I was not involved. I certainly was not an activist. I knew nothing about organizing. And I lived in suburban Indiana. So I thought that I was just starting an online conversation about gun violence prevention with other women and moms. And really what happened was amazing because
you post on Facebook.
That's I posted right. on Facebook, just sort of a call to action. And I created a Facebook page for that. It wasn't my personal page. And obviously so many women and moms had that same idea that day that it was time to get off the sidelines, because I was getting all of my public information was out there. So I was getting calls and emails and all of these people reaching out to me saying, hey, how do I start your organization where I live? And, you know, I didn't realize that I'd start an organization.
And your kids were how old at that point, the five of them? Were there any of them that were the same age as the kids who were killed?
My youngest was 12 at the time.
So it's already, like, obviously you're a parent of five, but not thinking of exactly of, like, this could have been my child, but also it could have been your child.
You know, I remember all of them being very teeny and being in first grade. And when it happened, my son was in elementary school. So I just felt a feeling I had never felt before, which was that my children were unsafe. And, you know, I do have to say that that is certainly a sign of privilege. Here I was, a white soccer mom in suburban Indiana. And my biggest concern about my kids going to school was, would they have friends? It wasn't, would they be shot and killed in their community, which, you know, we know now, I know now that Black children are exponentially shot and killed more than their white counterparts. But that's where I started, was really knowing nothing about the issue, only knowing that I wanted to keep my kids safe.
And so you're in Indiana. Where in Indiana?
I lived in Zionsville, which is a suburb of Indianapolis.
And where are you now?
Now I live in Colorado.
Right. And where in Colorado?
Boulder.
And have you found that there's a difference between the attitudes in Colorado and in Indiana?
I would say Indiana is a more red state, but Colorado is still surprisingly purple. We have a huge chapter in the state of Colorado, and there, in every state, there's this extreme radical group of gun owners that is sort of a subsidiary of the NRA. And in Colorado, it's called the Rocky Mountain Gun Owners. And they really have had a lot of sway over the state house and the legislators there. There's something every year called Gunmageddon, where we now show up by the dozens, even hundreds, to oppose bad gun bills. I think a lot of people think of Colorado as this, you know, blue law utopia, and it's not necessarily that.
But did your family ever own guns? Do you know people who own guns? What's your relationship on that side of it? Does it make any sense to you where this pushback is coming from when you are pushing for more gun laws?
I grew up with two grandfathers, both of whom fought in World War II. Both were gun owners and avid hunters. My
Did you ever hunt with them?
No, I did not. I was too little. But my ex-husband is a gun owner. It lives with down the street in Colorado. So being around gun owners was not something that I hadn't done before and wasn't strange to me. And that's why when we started Moms Demand Action, I wanted to make sure that we were welcoming gun owners into the group. Many of our volunteers are gun owners or they're married to gun owners. That's not what this is about. We are not about being anti-Second Amendment or we're not anti-gun. We are about restoring the responsibilities that go along with gun rights that I think the gun lobby has worked so hard to chip away at for decades.
But so let's just walk this through. You post the Facebook message. People start reaching out to you. How do I start a chapter of this organization that didn't exist? What are the next steps there as it starts to become realer and more professionalized? How does it pick up?
So I should say also that I am a full-time volunteer still. I wanted it to be an army of very angry moms and women to go toe-to-toe with the gun lobby. And so women started calling me, and I would have to say mainly from red states, to say, you know, I finally am finding people who agree with me, feel the same way about this issue, and we want to organize in Texas or in North Carolina or in Arkansas. And we would start giving them the tools to do that. So I worked with
But giving them the tools, where do you have the tools from?
I did communications for 20 years. So, you know, I knew how to do social media, message, create collateral. And I worked with other women who came into the fold who were volunteers who did have experience in organizing and who were lawyers or doctors and who knew a lot about this issue and helped me pull together what we needed. And everyone jumped in. I mean, we had a volunteer who only owned creating stateless Facebook pages. We had someone who owned organizing the chapters and creating what does a chapter look like. And we eventually modeled that after the Sierra Club. It's actually called the Snowflake model before Snowflake was a pejorative term for progressives. But it's this idea of
Snowflake branching out crystal, like how a crystal
exactly.
grows.
Right? You have one volunteer in the middle who is the chapter leader, and then they have a support system around them of data leads or membership or survivor outreach, whatever that chapter notes.
But really just like you sitting at your kitchen table or whatever, this is how
literally sitting at my kitchen table and working with women I had never met in my entire life, constantly on calls all day long. You know, it was 15-hour days that first couple of years. First, we worked to support the Manchin Toomey vote. That really was where all of our energy went.
Which is the vote, the background checks that was the initial and immediate legislative response from the Senate and from the Obama administration. Then, although it did not get as full-throated a push from Barack Obama as he would talk about having given it, and it failed, obviously, and it failed with notably a number of Democrats voting, not voting for it, right? And so not just Republicans not voting for it, but Democrats too.
A few, yeah. It failed by a handful of votes. Some of those Democratic senators, interestingly, the only one still in office is Heidi Heitkamp, the senator from North Dakota.
Right. So this was the spring of 2013, right after the shooting, and then a bunch of those people, Mark Pryor from Arkansas and Mark Begich from Alaska, did not win re-election in 2014.
Right. And in fact, in several of those races, even though they voted the way the NRA wanted them to, the NRA put millions of dollars into their opponents' elections. But that was really where all of our energy went that first few months. And then what was interesting was, I thought to myself, okay, well, is this it? You know, we've done what we tried to do, we failed, and maybe we just sort of pack this up and go back to our normal lives. And we had so many volunteers at that point, and we had become sort of a political powerhouse already. And our volunteers intuitively pivoted to doing this work in their state houses and in their boardrooms. And there were laws being looked at in the wake of Sandy Hook in states like Maryland and Connecticut and Delaware. And we had to support the bill that Hickenlooper, for example, passed in between Aurora and Sandy Hook that was a sweeping gun reform.
Colorado governor, Hickenlooper. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's where the work pivoted to. And about 6 months after Sandy Hook happened, Starbucks came out and said they were going to ban smoking 20 feet outside their stores, including electronic cigarettes, regardless of state law. And I called and I said, well, are you still going to allow open carry inside your stores? It's legal in 45 states, or at that time 44. And they said yes. And we decided we were much more scared of secondhand bullets than secondhand smoke. So we embarked on this campaign. Here we were, this very fledgling, brand new organization. And within 3 months, we were able to get the CEO of Starbucks to come out and say, guns are no longer welcome in our stores.
And all of this, the speed with which this has happened and the level of organization involved gets people who are critics of you suspicious that there must have been something else powering this, that this is not grassroots but is AstroTurf or whatever.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, I don't know if that's an example of sexism or if I should be honored and flattered, but, you know, I've never taken a dime and all of this work was done by mostly women who decided that, you know, their kids shouldn't go to school and practice how to die. And I really do believe that we are the yin to the gun lobby's yang. You know, we have that same fear and emotion, but we are using it as a force for good.
Mm-hmm. You think it's just the mom's thing is what caught that? That's the...
I do. I think, look, when I looked to join an organization in the wake of Sandy Hook, I could have supported a think tank in D.C. or I could have joined some of these individual state organizations, mm-hmm. almost all of them run by men. And women are only 20% of Congress. We only hold about 25% of state legislative seats. We're less than 1% of Fortune 100 CEOs. So we aren't getting to make the laws and the policies that impact the safety of our families. And I think that women were looking for a way to do this that helped us pull the levers of power available to us, our votes, because we're the majority of the voting public, our spending power. We make about 80% of our family spending decisions, and our voices. You know, we show up in meetings and in every single gun bill hearing in this country. And when lawmakers see us, they're scared.
They're scared because they think they're going to lose elections?
They know that we're holding them accountable. They know that people are watching and they're going to bring it back up when it's time for them to run again. And they know that we're going to vote for or against them depending on how they vote.
And has it happened if people lost their re-elections because of actions that you guys have taken?
Absolutely. I mean, we're very proud of the fact that we helped Senator Ayotte get unseated.
In New Hampshire, who was with that Manchin Toomey vote, lost her reelection bid in 2016. But what about on the local level, state legislators? Are there people, do you have your hit list?
Yes, we do. I mean, you know, it recently in Arkansas, we had a volunteer who joined us. She was a professor at the university in Fayetteville. And she was so upset because she saw the NRA pushing guns on campus. And then I think people were shocked and dismayed that that bill actually passed. And it was really how we became such a huge force in the state of Arkansas. And she helped build that chapter. And after all of that work, she realized that she wanted to move from just shaping policy to making it. And so she ran for the state house there and won and unseated someone who had been a big proponent of the NRA.
And is that the success story, or are there others that you can say this person lost? Well, that's somebody who herself got into it,
yeah,
and ran. But are there other people that you think, because of things that you guys have done, are now no longer in
Absolutely.
Office?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in addition to holding them accountable by votes, we also, with Every Town for Gun Safety, are able to invest in people's campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, in Oregon, there had been two lawmakers in the state house who had been opposing background checks for years. And one of them was nicknamed Machine Gun Betty because she had a machine gun. And those were the two people standing in the way of background checks every year. And we were able to unseat them, get their opponents elected, and go back in and pass background checks through the legislature.
Well, so you mentioned Every Town for Gun Safety. That's Mike Bloomberg's organization. As a person who covered several of his mayoral campaigns, I know there's a lot of money Mike Bloomberg can put into things and has. What is the way that they get hooked up with you guys? Because that obviously, for all of the time that you spent at your kitchen table, that infusion of money and organization obviously helped with what you guys
are doing. Yeah, so I would say about 6 months to a year in, I realized that we were going to have to partner with another organization. We had come such a long way in such a short time, but we were subsisting mainly on online donations. And so I started interviewing organizations inside and outside the space, organizations that did.
You started interviewing, not they
yes.
started interviewing
no,
you.
No, no. I started calling people and saying, you know, we're interested in giving you our grassroots power, but in exchange, you know, how could that
uh-huh.
work? And so I did sit down with lots of organizations and interview them. And eventually I just really loved Mike's team. John Feinblatt, you know, is the brilliant strategist behind marriage equality in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mike was leading Mayors Against Illegal Guns. I was leading Moms Demand Action. And what we did was to put the umbrella of Every Town for Gun Safety over the top of it.
And it's like somewhat you were in like a gondola ride in Montana or something.
Yeah.
What is this?
So I had been having conversations with Mark Glaze, who was at that time the executive director of Mayors Against Illegal Guns and eventually of Every mm-hmm. Town. He's no longer there, but Mark is a great guy. And after I had done these interviews with Mike's team, Mark asked me to join him in Montana and to talk about what could Every Town for Gun Safety look like. And we just rode up and down a gondola
Why?
In the middle of summer. We met in this very random ski area that was in between the two vacation places where we were.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Mark's just a super creative person. And so we were able to sort of sit on a gondola for hours and talk about what would this look like.
But so that leads to, again, there are people who say like, oh, this is all just a front, right? And in this case, it's the Mike Bloomberg thing, right? And he's been for over a decade the enemy of the gun movement, right? And somebody that the NRA talks about as doing the wrong thing all the time. So why should people not see what you're doing as just putting a good face on or a different face on Mike Bloomberg?
Well, look, I was the enemy of the NRA one week in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like they were going to like
how,
me
how
more
did you
than
know
they liked
that?
Mike. Well, I started getting death threats and threats of sexual violence within 24 hours after starting my Facebook page. I had to call the police. There have been times when I had to get a lawyer to get a restraining order. The vitriol started immediately. And I think the goal was to shut me up and to stop this organization from forming.
But that's not from the NRA directly, right?
From gun extremists.
Right.
Yeah. But the NRA also that since then has you know, Dana Loesch showed up at an event I was at to try to, you know, bully me into an interview, and they featured me in their magazine, and they often do.
What happened when she showed up? She's the NRA spokesperson and radio host, and
yeah, I was in Indianapolis with my kids at a Moms Demand Action event, not even near the venue where the NRA was holding their annual meeting. We were at a park, and just
But
calling for
timed,
background checks.
Timed to
we do this every year. Yeah. We show up wherever the NRA is holding its annual meeting. And she showed up in full makeup with a camera crew and started aggressively like putting a mic in my face. And the thing she was really upset about, which is funny, is that she was upset I had said she was an NRA shill, which she didn't work for NRA at the time, but she does now. And you know, just was trying to sort of confront me in front of my kids. And that was very much her style pre-NRA employment. But the NRA does feature me in all of their magazines, and they do a lot of cartoon characters, and they're not a fans.
And what does that lead to? Do you have security with you all the time? Has it changed the way that you have to lead your life?
Absolutely. Again, it's bizarre to me that I have to travel with a bodyguard. I have to use an alias when I travel, all because I just want background checks on every gun sale. It's a very strange part of American culture.
Is your bodyguard armed?
No. So his job is to go scope out the hospitals, and if I get shot, he would take me to one as quickly as possible.
Because that's the argument that often comes from they would.
Well, I just think that's so silly too. Anyway, look, bodyguards, security guards, police who have guns, they have background checks, they have training, they have permits, they have, you know, all of the things that we're calling for the average civilian to have that the NRA doesn't think you should have to have a gun.
But you, it seems like, specifically did not want your bodyguard to be armed.
No, I don't actually know why he's not armed. I don't know what that choice was made, but I'm indifferent. You know, it's like I wouldn't do this work mm-hmm. if I was scared all the time.
But you must be scared sometimes.
I really am not. You know, I honestly think that I am on the right side of history and that if, God forbid, anything were to happen, it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
And do your kids feel that way?
You know, my people always ask me what my kids think about this. It's funny. It's if you have teens, you know that they really only think about themselves on a day-to-day basis. So, I mean, I think that they're proud of me and I think that they're interested. But at the end of the day, you know, I think they're glad that this helped me focus on something other than their own lives.
But do people show up at your home? Has that
happened? Yes, we've had that happen. We have had people.
So that must throw your kids, right? And that must throw you.
I think that we are of a personality which is, you know, if you're going to mess with me, I'll mess with you right back. And so I don't think that there's – let me put it this way. If there was ever a time where my kids said they were scared and didn't want me to do this, or my husband said he was scared and didn't want me to do this, I would have had to think twice about it. And it's just never been something I've had to face.
So you talked about what started happening – on the state level, there was the Manchin-Toomey bill in 2013, and then that failed, and it was basically the end of any attempt to do anything in Washington. For all the talk that ended up, and Obama would say all the way through the end of his presidency, "Oh, my greatest regret is not doing anything on guns," but he never came back at it. And Joe Biden would talk about it, but also Joe Biden never came back at it. And there was this they would sometimes say, well, the Senate has only gotten less Democratic, so there's no chances. But there wasn't any real conversation about it happening at the national level. So you guys moved to the states. And what happens now is that like at every hearing, there are women who show up with these T-shirts.
Right. Red T-shirts. This was before Trump's Make America Great Again hat, I should point out.
And I, years ago, covered state government. It was in Albany in New York where there's not much transparency about anything. But the couple of hearings that did exist, nobody would attend. There wouldn't even be reporters at them, which I would imagine is what most of these would look like before you guys started going.
Yeah, we decided early on that we were going to show up at every single gun bill hearing, and even if we thought we might lose, we were going to show up in mass and make sure lawmakers knew that we were watching and paying attention. And it has made a difference. When you show up, for example, in Oklahoma, you know, we have something called the Minute Moms. It was actually started by a man who is a 70-year-old veteran, Moms Demand Action member. And there isn't much time for a gun bill hearing in Oklahoma, really on any hearing. And so what he does is he'll use like sort of an old-fashioned phone tree, and he gets all of these volunteers to sit at the state house and to put pressure on lawmakers. In Kansas this year, we had volunteers with Moms Demand Action sit in the state house for 17 hours to kill a permitless carry bill.
And did it work?
It did, yeah. that bill did not pass.
So is it just showing up, you think?
I think that is half the battle in democracy, is just showing up. And it's really painstaking, unglamorous, heavy lifting. If you've ever sat at a state house for over 10 hours, it is not the most fun way to spend your time.
It is a terrible way to spend time.
But it does make a difference. And we see that over and over again. We have a 90% track record of killing bad bills every single year, again this year in post Parkland. Mm-hmm. Not only did we kill 90% of bad NRA bills, but we also passed over 1,000 good bills, mm-hmm. one of the strongest years we've ever had.
And has it created a reaction of other people, proponents of these laws, showing up to counter you guys?
It's a really interesting question. So what we see most of the time is that it's dozens or hundreds of Moms Demand Action volunteers and one NRA lobbyist or two NRA lobbyists. Florida is a great example of that, Texas. Mm-hmm. But there have been times when there's been a divisive vote in the state house that has caused some gun extremists to show up. A good example is in Rhode Island. There were gun extremists opposing a bill that would disarm domestic abusers that the NRA had opposed as well. And so we showed up, and we showed up in a huge group of gun extremists. But that is rare. In Maryland, we showed up, and there were, I would say, two dozen of us and about a dozen gun extremists. And the media caught this all on camera and in print, but we started having a dialogue. And this was around a domestic gun violence bill. And eventually, we all agreed to agree that domestic abusers shouldn't have guns, and the gun extremists left.
Do you think that this issue has changed?
Oh, absolutely.
Why?
I think because we had such a succession of horrific national shooting tragedies.
So it's just, is it that?
That's in part. Yeah. I don't think it's just that. I do think it's a big part of it is that we've laid this amazing foundation for people to join us. So because we organized so efficiently after Parkland, we were able to absorb 200,000 new active volunteers.
So what does that bring you to?
Nearly 300,000 volunteers. So we have about 5 million supporters.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. You have 5 million supporters. And how many active volunteers?
Close to 300,000.
And 200,000 of them came
just
post Parkland?
Yes.
So you were at 100,000 on February 13th.
Exactly.
And since February 14th, 200,000.
And just to put it in perspective, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has been around since the 80s, has about 15,000 active volunteers.
How did that – what was it that – what happened there? That's a lot of people. It's 200,000.
It's a huge amount of people. Right? I think – well, first of all, I do think that Parkland was a watershed moment for this issue.
Why do you think that was?
I mean, clearly
there are shooting. There was a shooting in Texas, and it was not long afterwards, but it didn't have the kind of impact that it did. Is it just that it's these kids who, a combination of media savvy, like inherent media savvy that they had, and the way that it played out that made it happen?
I don't know that that's it. And look, I've met these kids. They're great kids. I am particularly fond of Emma Gonzalez. She's amazing. I think what was unique about Parkland was this the first and maybe only time we've seen an entire community galvanize around one specific message and call to action within hours. Mm-hmm. And that was that we needed stronger gun laws. And I don't know that we've ever seen that before or after.
I mean, the thing that struck me when they did the March on Washington at the end of March, what was that, about 6 weeks after the shooting, was having been to these marches that have been going on to cover them since Trump's inauguration, starting with the Women's March the day afterwards, is that guns march had a sense of, okay, you've got to go vote. I walked around the Women's March the day after Trump's inauguration, and I said to all these people who were there with all these signs, I said, well, what are you going to do tomorrow? And they're like, well, I don't know. Maybe try to get involved at home and this, whatever. Whereas at the March for Our Lives, people were walking around with clipboards with voter registration cards on them. The whole thing ended with a video about voting. It was much more directed and much more organized from the get-go, and has continued to be. And they also, it should be said, had some interplay with the Bloomberg organization, right? And that helped a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Moms Demand Action has supported them because we've done events over and over all across the country, and we work with them on registering people to vote. But they're very independent, and they are raising their own dollars for the most part, and have their own agenda and goals. Mm-hmm. Our focus is on what you just said, which is the organizing part. It's great to have marches and rallies, but you also have to have action. And I think that's why we've been more focused on the organizing part than the marches and rallies, which we did early on, because we realized there was so much power in showing up and in having in-district meetings with federal lawmakers or meeting with state lawmakers, going to local boardrooms and having these discussions. It's like drips on a rock, but that is ultimately how change gets made.
And you've got a lot of moms themselves running this year, right? There's the woman you mentioned in Arkansas, but how many do we have now, candidates themselves for office?
We have several dozens running in November. We've just endorsed, it's our first round of endorsements. Mm-hmm. We've just endorsed 16 of them. This last February, we had 13 run, 9 won. And I'm going to be spending a lot of time between now and November traveling and supporting them. I was actually just in Iowa supporting a woman named Amber Gustafson, and she was one of the founding members of our chapter in Iowa. And now she's running for state senator against the Senate Majority Leader.
Mm-hmm.
People said it was a long shot. Recent polling shows they're almost tied up. And this is a person who is being groomed to replace Chuck Grassley.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a significant win for us in that state.
Do you think about running yourself?
I don't know that I would be able to make more change than I'm able to make doing this. As the founder of Moms Demand Action, it's a tough row to hoe to run for politics. I don't know that that's in my future. I am working on a book right now mm-hmm. that's going to come out in early summer of 2019. And we'll just see where it goes from there.
And the book is your story?
It's tentatively called One Tough Mother, but it's all about the how we did this, you mm-hmm. know, kind of the questions that you're asking me right
so
now.
So we're spoiling the whole book.
That's right. No, there'll be many more stories in there.
What's the difference between people like the woman you mentioned in Iowa saying, since you've walked through this with a lot of people, the okay, we want to get involved and go to meetings and show up at hearings to – okay, put themselves forward here. It must be enough of a difference in your mind that it's kept you from thinking about running yourself.
Well, you know, I'm the tip of the spear. And the NRA would invest heavily in I think, disparaging the legacy of Moms Demand Action. So I have a different outlook when I think about running personally. But these are women who have been showing up in their state houses now for almost 6 years. They're a huge part of their community. They've learned from us how to be activists, how to fundraise, how to hold events, how to message and knock doors. And look, I think a lot of these women spend time in state houses and realize that their lawmakers are not rocket scientists. In fact, one woman said, I don't know that I would trust these people to get me a cup of coffee, let alone make the policies that are, you know, determining whether my family is safe. So I think that is what we see across the country, unfortunately, too often. And they want to move from shaping policy to actually being the ones making it.
And look, the NRA endorsement used to be one of the most powerful things in politics. still is. But do you find that people are chasing you down for the endorsements? It's just the first round that came out at the end of July. But there will be more. I think probably 6 years ago, to be endorsed by an anti-gun group or anti-gun violence group. I'm sorry, would have been somewhat inconceivable as something that would be sought out. And in fact, I mean, I remember there were people who were targeted specifically for being associated with Mike Bloomberg, right? It was Colorado state senators. There were a couple of them and others in the early stages of what Bloomberg was doing. Now that's not the way this looks. So
I think it's a great point, and it really does show that the tides are changing. So two things. First is we decided to give out these Gun Sense Distinction Candidate Awards this year. We thought we would give out a couple hundred. This is the first year we've ever done it. And basically, these candidates fill out a questionnaire. Because we have a grassroots army, we can get them the questionnaires. And if mm-hmm. they don't want to fill them out, that also sends another signal, right? But when they do, then we review it and decide whether to give them the distinction. We thought we'd give out a couple hundred. We've given out over 2,500 mm-hmm. this year already.
For State House, for Congress, for Senate?
State House and Congress mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's interesting about it is it's both Republicans and Democrats, more Democrats than Republicans, but I think that's a good sign. And the other piece that's interesting is that the NRA took down all of its ratings
right.
of candidates recently. Thankfully, we saved all those ratings going back
and
to 2009.
And their logic on that, what was their argument about?
They didn't say, but I think you can't – the only thing you can deduct is that they realize that those are actually a scarlet letter, not a badge of honor now to have an A rating.
But you guys had kept them all.
We kept them all.
And you put them up.
Yeah.
Because you thought that they would be.
Because we think it is a scarlet letter.
But why did you keep, why were you archiving them? Because you thought that might
smart.
Happen?
Because you got to have those ratings just in case.
Well, it certainly served you well to have them. And all of this is playing out against the backdrop of what's going on with the Russia investigation here and new things that we have learned about what seems to be some sort of interplay. And we don't know how deep the causal relationship is and between Russia and some money that went to the NRA and then money that went in support of Donald Trump.
Right. So we know that the NRA spent $30 million on Donald Trump's campaign. About three times as much as they had ever spent on any preceding presidential election. They've not been clear. They don't have to be clear about where that money comes
right.
from. You know, it's being reported that the FBI is looking into whether there was an exchange of money between Russia, the NRA, and Donald Trump's campaign.
You think there was?
It doesn't look good. I mean, it looks very suspicious. You know, I obviously don't have all of the details yet, but I think it looks suspicious. And now we're talking about this alleged Russian agent mm-hmm. who's been arrested, who has very deep ties, clearly infiltrated the upper ranks of NRA leadership. And I think we're about to see a lot of proof that the NRA is an extreme radicalized political organization and not in any way a hunting or sportsman's organization.
Couldn't it have just been that they felt that Barack Obama had made a lot of efforts to scale up gun laws, and they believed that Hillary Clinton was going to, and that they wanted to stop her from being in office to do that?
It's possible, but look, I think we should never underestimate the NRA. I mean, they're very shrewd lobbyists, and they seem to have two ways of doing things. One is to rely on Democrats and being in office so that they can make money and say your guns are going to be taken away. And the other is to leverage Republicans when they're in office to chip away at stronger gun laws. And they seem to make a pretty suspicious bet early on Donald Trump when no one else thought he would win.
And to you, that just is another part of this Russia. And I should say, and I've been having this conversation a lot in the last couple of weeks, there were things that I was being told, hunches that people had about what was going on with Russia and the 2016 election while it was going down that I didn't really believe at the time, and that having had this conversation with some of the people who were talking to me, they didn't even really believe it at the time. They were pitching me on things. Some of those things have proven to be exactly in the indictments that have come out from the Mueller team. So what we have seen so far is maybe the tip of the iceberg with this or maybe all that there is. But there's certainly something about what was going on.
Well, and it goes all the way back to 2011, which is when Maria Butina started mm-hmm. her so-called gun rights organization in a country where there was very little opportunity or reality that there would be gun rights for civilians. And at the same time, John Bolton became part of the NRA's mm-hmm. International Affairs Subcommittee. We know that 2 years later, he made a video for Maria Butina's organization. And
it's a weird video that it exists at all.
Video.
It almost actually seems like one of those things that Sacha Baron Cohen gets people to record because there is no Second Amendment in Russia. There's
right.
no and he's like talking about how they need to have essentially, it doesn't say a Second Amendment, but that they need to have guns and the freedom that comes with it. And there's really no reason for it to exist.
No.
That anybody's been able to understand, except that he believes in gun rights and seems to have been
when he was part of the NRA's
right, and seemed to feel like okay, well, this is seems like a friendly organization, and but that is the way that people get duped into saying
exactly.
things by Sacha Baron Cohen too.
Right,
it's
our reality right.
right
now. Yeah, but you know, she hosted two delegations of U.S. officials and NRA mm-hmm. leaders to Russia. And she attended three NRA annual meetings. And then going back to John Bolton, you know, it's said that he is the one who is sort of creating this meeting in the fall with Donald Trump. So there's just a lot of tentacles all over that are starting to make a little more sense.
After the Parkland shooting, President Trump had a bunch of members of the House and the Senate over to the White House, and he talked about how a lot of presidents have talked about things, but nobody's ever acted on it, and he was going to act on it, that he wasn't scared of the NRA. They might be scared of the NRA, but not him. In the subsequent days, he met privately then with the NRA in the Oval Office and didn't follow up on what happened. And there was so much of – he was under some pressure politically at that moment and then turned to something that he has done at other moments of political pressure, which is to have all the cameras on him for the meetings. And there was definitely a good show being done there. Did you ever think at all that was happening that you were going to see any action come out of Trump?
No. That the story you're telling is the story that most people tell, but there's a piece that isn't well known, which is that a White House official came out after that initial conversation that Trump had with senators and said, we were given permission by the NRA to say those things. In other words, it was an attempt to juice gun sales. Yes. Gun manufacturers are in the hole over $100 million since Donald Trump was elected because they don't have a boogeyman in the White House to make you afraid.
Well, this was the crazy thing that would happen every time that there would be a shooting when Obama was president, is that it would actually lead to a spike in gun sales because there was this anxiety that he would respond by creating more gun laws. And so they needed to buy the guns while they could. Meanwhile, Obama didn't do anything actually, and so all that happened was there would be a shooting and then there would be a spike in gun sales and Obama would not do anything
right.
with it.
The NRA's annual budget went up over $100 million in the wake of Sandy Hook up to $350 million because they were sort of rolling in the money, being able to exploit a tragedy for gun sales. And so they have suffered a great deal in gun sales and accessory sales. I think they thought they would put their priority legislation through the first year Trump was elected, which in part, thanks to us, they did not. They've tried to pass concealed carry reciprocity. They've tried to deregulate silencers. None of that happened.
Well, the concealed carry reciprocity would be that you would only be subject to the concealed carry laws of your own home state, right? Even when you were traveling in other states.
Exactly.
So you could get a gun in, let's say, Texas, where there are much looser gun laws, and go to New York, where there are much more stringent gun laws, but you could still have the concealed weapon.
Exactly.
That's with it.
It's an extremely dangerous concept.
But it was it's a really sort of in some ways esoteric issue, but it had been the NRA had set it as its priority issue for Congress last year.
They've tried to pass it several times and failed. And I think they really thought, okay, well, with Donald Trump president, we'll be able to pass this quickly, and they haven't. And you know, back to your original question, I'm always hopeful that something will happen with this Congress and this president, but also realizing—
Are you always hopeful? You seem to
I'm
be pretty cynical
hopeful.
About that.
I'm not, because I do think there are senators who could change their minds. Whether it's for political reasons or for a change of heart and mind.
But you think there's a chance that in your mind, President Trump would change his mind?
No, I don't see him changing his mind. Again, the NRA was one of his largest outside
right.
donors. So
when
I
you're watching that meeting that Trump was having, your response to it at that moment is what?
I didn't believe what he was saying for a second. And I think that was proven true by the fact that it was an attempt to go back to the days of a horrific mass shooting where the NRA could say, your guns are going to be taken away.
So where does this lead us? Do you think that we're going to have you're hopeful that your candidates will win in November? Do you think that we are looking at the possibility of a different gun debate happening in Washington, or is it just going to happen on the state level?
We are going to keep working on the state level. You have to protect the gains you've made and continue to make more. Just like marriage equality, in many ways, it's taking a page out of that playbook. But I do think if we flip Congress, if we flip the House, flip the Senate, there's a possibility for change. And look, the president may decide that his fortunes don't lie with the NRA. They're underwater in terms of their popularity poll for the first time since 2000. So you never know with politics.
But you don't really believe that. You just said that you don't think President Trump will flip.
I don't think he would now.
Yeah.
But we're starting to look at an environment where the NRA is being implicated with Russia, where their popularity is at an all-time low. He could decide to divorce himself from the NRA. Now, I don't know that that will happen, but we'll see. And look, I always think it's worth the Senate and Congress continuing to push this movement forward. They've never stopped. I think that's part of why we're still having this discussion. Senators like Chris Murphy, congressmen like Mike Thompson, this has become a priority issue for them. And they have had sit-ins and filibusters and have never let it go.
Define success for me.
Success is continuing to pass strong gun laws at the state level. It's continuing to kill bad bills, which I think a lot of people don't realize is a huge part of what you have to do on this issue. It's getting CEOs and companies involved to realize that when lawmakers don't protect their constituents, they have to protect their customers. And it is harnessing the votes of the 90% of Americans who support what we're working toward to actually vote on that issue.
Do you think that come 2020, there will be any room in the Democratic Party for people who aren't where you are on gun laws?
I can't imagine a strong Democratic candidate who opposed background checks on every gun sale. You'd be going against 90% of your constituents.
Do you think that that's an issue that will define 2018, define 2020, or is it that there's so much else going on that it's hard for this to be the thing that jumps out, even though obviously every time that there's a shooting?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the sad part, right? And that's what I frankly dread about September, my son going back to his senior year of high school, because we see that start to happen then.
Your son, who was the 12-year-old when Sandy happened.
He was the 12-year-old. Yeah. He's now a senior in high school. Yeah. I think politics, as you know, is constantly changing. So who knows what 2020 is going to look like and if we'll be grappling with another horrific shooting tragedy as a nation. But I think what Hillary Clinton did prove, she won the popular vote ultimately, and gun violence prevention was a major part of her policy platform. She had mothers of the movement who toured with her all across the country, and she did that not just because she felt strongly about it, but because polling showed that it was an issue that was a winning issue.
Do you think at all about you took some inspiration from Mothers Against Drunk Driving? You said from the gay marriage fight. What you have done is so specific to mothers and to this issue. Is there, because especially since Trump won, every week, certainly for the first 6 months of his presidency, would get a different group. Oh, we're starting to do this, whatever. And I would always say, well, like, who's backing you? What is your organization and financing? And what is it that you exactly want to get done? And some of them would get mad at me asking those questions. They were like, well, we're just trying to do something. And I would say that most of the people who got mad at me for asking that question don't run organizations that exist anymore. So are there things – is there any other issue that you would look at and say, okay, they could learn from what we did?
I think the way we have organized can be applied to almost any issue. It's part why I'm writing a book, because I get those calls too, which the calls that I get are, how do I start this movement in my neighborhood or in my community or even at a national level? And I do think there are certain ingredients that go into an organization that helps you stay around for the long term. I think we have a really sophisticated brand. You know, we have Moms Demand Action volunteers who get tattoos of our logo on their arm every year. And so there's...
You haven't gotten a tattoo?
I haven't yet. I'm being asked to around the book time, but we'll see. I don't, my husband, who was born in 1959, is very hesitant for his wife to have ink, I think, but we'll see.
I mean, it would be a good book promotion
it
thing.
It would, so. You know, my pain. I think there's several ingredients. It includes a sophisticated brand that empowers people and makes them feel like they're part of something. I think it includes sophisticated, nonpartisan, moderate messaging. I think it includes tangible goals and outcomes, like we just talked about with state houses and boardrooms. But I also think you have to have some wins under your belt.
Yeah.
And I think when people see us winning, they want to be part of that.
Do you have any Republican elected officials who are connected with you guys? Any who have sought out the endorsement?
Yeah, we do. And I think Bucks County is a good example where there are both Democrats and Republicans running. And every single candidate, I believe, in that race has a gun sense distinction. But I do find over, you know, I've seen, watched this shift over the last almost 6 years where Republicans sort of assumed that that had to be their position and that they had to dig in their heels. And now I think what they're seeing is that they can slowly evolve on this issue. And I think that's so important. It's not just about voting out people who don't support us, but it's about allowing people to change their minds and evolve. Maybe you did have an A rating from the NRA and you took money from them. But if you decide that that's not the direction you want to go in and you're going to change that, we have to make room for those people too.
All right, Shannon Watts, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Are you surprised that this group has been able to become what it has? Does it strike you as a good or a bad thing that they're part of the conversation in the way they are? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe and rate us so you don't miss an episode coming up. And follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover for more on upcoming podcasts and so much more. And catch you next time on Off Message.